Today's November 18th, and we are going to do, starting a whole chunk on Nazir. So really, we're not going to start with the next mitzvah, we're going to start with the in the middle mitzvah, and then go backwards. And I'll tell you why. You'll get your, this is for your test. Make sure you remember this.
Okay.
So today we're going to do 368 through 374, but we're going to start with 374. And the reason for that is your piece of trivia that you should remember for your test.
Okay.
And that is that when the Sefer HaChinuch was initially written, it was written by Parsha, just the way that we're doing it, goes through all the mitzvahs in the Torah, but originally he wrote all the positive mitzvahs first and all the negative mitzvahs second in each Parsha. The way that we have it today is in actual chronological order of the verses. So if there's a verse that says, keep the Sabbath and make it holy, don't desecrate the Sabbath, that's two different mitzvahs, a positive and a negative. So it will have the positive and then that negative and then the next positive. Right? But initially when he wrote it, it was all the positives of that parsha and then all the negatives of that parsha. So because of that, let's just look on page 33, which will take us right into 374. So page 33, we're going to go, that's in the middle of mitzvah 368. 368 is the mitzvah that a nazir is forbidden to drink wine or any strong wine drink. So if you look on page 33, in the section about the roots of the mitzvah, Shor Shei HaMitzvah, bless you, it says, about the root purpose of the theme of the nazir, I wrote in the fourth positive precept of this Sedra, 374, what I know. And that, right, so now that's what we want to look up. Because he already wrote what we want to read, except for the fact that it's ahead of us.
Okay.
Right? So, because it was rearranged. Okay, so let's start with 374, because that's really what we want
to
read. So,
wait, who rearranged this? In the publisher, just to make it easier, or what?
Yeah, I think probably it was rearranged before this publisher.
Uh-huh.
That it was originally written that way, and then it got rearranged because it was just easier to follow that way. Mm-hmm. But occasionally you do have, see what I wrote... Mm-hmm. And what he's referring to is still ahead, not behind. It's nice in this particular one that they give you all the notes and tell you where everything is, so you don't have to worry about it. You don't have to look around. Okay, so good. That's why we're starting with
okay.
This. What is a nazir? Okay, so a nazir is a specific commitment, a person who has taken on a specific commitment. The specific commitment is to not cut one's hair, to not partake of any wine or grape products at all whatsoever, and to not become tamei meit, or certain other tumas, which we'll see. So now we have, I think, 10 different mitzvahs. Maybe it's more.
Is the period of time optional?
And the period of time is, it's for a specific period of time. Okay, and so the minimum is 30 days, and if you don't specify, it's 30 days. So the default is 30 days. But you can specify it for as long as you want, or for a lifetime. The way that one stops being a nazir, even if they specified, just doing this for 30 days, or if they didn't specify, which means default is 30 days, the only way one can actually stop is after that time period, they have to go to the temple, shave their hair off, and burn it under a sacrifice, and whatever else they have to do, which we'll see. So, today there's no temple. Bless you. So there's no way of getting out of it.
Hmm.
But one could still enter into it. So
all body hair or just head or
hair? Just head hair. Yeah. Yes, I'm pretty sure. That's my understanding. Yeah. Anyway, so that's the, so you can't get out of it today. So it's happens occasionally that somebody, I heard a story where somebody took it upon themselves and had to figure out how to get out of it. And I think he was released in the end from it. But it was basically an Israeli guy who went to the army and did the usual post-army thing of that time in the 70s and 80s, which was... What did every Israeli guy almost do after the army in the 70s and 80s?
They went to India.
They went to India. Yeah. In fact, my niece, Ricky, went to India. She's 29 now. She went to India like 5 years ago, maybe. And she learned some Hindi before she went. She was part of some college program. And when she came back, I asked her, how was it? Did the Hindi that you learned help? You know, she learned 20 phrases or something. She said, yeah. She said, but as soon as I got into the main cities, there were so many signs in Hebrew that I really didn't have to worry about it. There's so many Israelis in India.
When we were in Bangkok, right? It was a Chabad rabbi who dealt with a lot of Israelis.
Yeah, yeah.
There's post-war, post-army.
Post-army, right. Post-army, it's very common to take a year and go somewhere, do something. So used to be India was the place because people used to be, and we in America are also not, but people used to be on quests. Want to go find themselves. Where do you find yourself but India, right? Or whatever, you're backpacking through Europe. But look, nobody does that anymore. But the Israelis today do still often, when they leave the army, go somewhere. So where do they go today? One place you should all know.
Don't they go to Vietnam or Thailand or Cambodia?
I don't think so.
Australia.
I don't know. They go two main places. One is South America, and the other is malls in North America.
Malls?
Malls.
M-A-L-L-S, malls.
That's correct. So if you go to any mall today, you will see in the kiosks in the middle.
Yes, right?
Gobs of Israelis.
Israelis.
That's right.
They were selling the space.
They sell Dead Sea products. In the malls everywhere across North America, pretty much, you will see Israelis selling stuff.
Where in South America?
And then they backpack through South America.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. That's still where there still is a backpacking thing, but it's no longer a quest. It's just fun. Yeah. So the backpacking is South America these days, and the money-making is the malls, and India is not so much. Anyway, so in the 70s, 80s, at some point there, some Israeli went to India and was on an ashram and was finding himself, and one day he, I don't know, read a Bible or something, and as he's reading, he's like, this resonates with me. I'm Jewish, actually, and look at what's going on here. And he read the section on Nazir. And he said, I've got to get back to myself and who I am. I'm going to become a Nazir. And he started to keep whatever he could from the, he made that commitment, and he stopped cutting his hair, and he didn't drink. Then he goes back to Israel, home, and he becomes Orthodox. He goes to yeshiva, and he studies more, and he realizes what he did to himself. He can never get out of it. And he looks like a caveman, right? And he does get married, but his kids are freaks because his father's a freak. He looks like a freak in the community.
Someone married him.
And his kids are having a hard time getting play dates and getting into schools. And now he's a true Orthodox Jew. I'm pretty sure he got out of it some, but it was a whole big halachic discussion because there's not too many Nazirs today. So the question is, did he understand? I think that's how they nullified it. Did he understand what he was taking on when he took it on? Like, did he understand the ramifications? Mm-hmm. Was it taken on with full cognizance of what he was getting into?
It's naive. So you can get out of things if you're naive.
Apparently not. Sometimes uh-huh. you can. Sometimes. So anyway, so why do we do it? So let's look at the page 45. What's the root reason for this precept? So this is where all the philosophy is in this. It's an interesting thing. So we'll read it inside. The root reason for this precept is a preface. Right? He's going to begin with a preface. I wrote previously at the opening of the work that since there is in the world of the Holy One, blessed is he, a creature composed of both physical matter and intelligence, namely man, it should be a fitting and necessary thing in order that his praise should ascend well from his humans, that with this human creature no possibility which is in our power to grasp should be lacking from his world, and so forth, as I wrote there. Meaning, God created us, we are a mixture of physical and spiritual, we're here to really connect with God, so we should actually be very spiritual and not have all this physical in the way, or the physical should only be there to facilitate the spiritual. However, that's not the case, right? Now, there's no doubt that if not for this reason, that our intelligence was compelled to dwell within physical matter, given to cravings and sins, our intelligence would have been fit to stand and minister before its creator, and to recognize his glory, like one of the divine angels that are ranged about him. However, because of this ordained necessity, our intelligence was subjugated and constrained to live in physical dwellings, that is, our body and the world. And having been subjugated to this, it is compelled in any event to turn aside from the service of its creator at times and to exert effort for the needs of the dwelling in which it lodges. For the structure of a house, its timber, stones, and foundations will not endure without man giving it watchful care. Right? So we are spiritual beings housed in a physical dwelling. The physical dwelling takes time and attention. Time and attention is limited. So you can either give it to your body or you can give it to your soul. That's you don't get to do both at that moment. It goes one or the other. So every moment you have to take towards the physical does take away from the spiritual quest, unless you know how to go use the physical to achieve the spiritual. However, let's just keep looking. Since it is so, inasmuch as the purpose set for man in his formation is what we have stated. So. Okay. At any time that his intelligence can lessen its service for the physical matter, it sets its aim towards the service of its maker. It is good for it then, provided it does not abandon the chores of the dwelling. Oh yeah, you're getting here soon. It should come this week. Anyway, so we can use our intelligence to go in either direction if we choose to, but it's often pulled in the physical direction. Let's say you want to elevate yourself, right? Let's see. You can do that, but you cannot completely wreck your physical dwelling by not taking care of it. That's what it's saying here. For this would be considered a sin for him, since the king desires to have a human being like that, a human being that's mixed body and soul. As Raviosi said in chapter 3 of the Talmud tractate Ta'anit, which means fasting, an individual does not have the right to afflict himself by fasting. And Rabbi Yehuda, in the name of Rav, explained Rabbi Yossi's reason. It is because it is written, and man became a living soul. The Torah states, thus, in effect, the soul that I sent you, you have to keep it alive. That I sent in you, do you keep alive? In this vein, the wise King Solomon said, so this is interesting from Ecclesiastes, do not be righteous overmuch, and do not make yourself overwise. Why should you destroy yourself? Let's hear that in Hebrew. Al tehi tzadik harbe. Don't be too much of a tzadik. That's what it's saying. Al tehi tzadik harbe v'al titchakam yoter. And don't be too smart. Why should you destroy yourself? Lama tishomim. Why should you destroy yourself? That's the pasuk in Kohelet, right? Don't be too much of a tzadik and don't be too smart. You'll destroy yourself if you are, right? You should be a tzadik. But don't become such a tzaddik that you completely ignore the physical, because you'll fall apart if you do. You can't do that. Yes.
Or too much of the physical.
Yes, you know, this is about don't be a tzaddik.
Yeah.
So that's don't be too little of the physical.
But I was thinking also in the 13th and 14th century, some of the followers of Christianity scourged themselves, and they
right.
would march in these parades behind
right.
the cross, and they'd be beating themselves
right.
because that was supposed to enhance their spirituality.
By diminishing the physical.
Body. Right.
So that's what it's saying. Don't be too much of a tzaddik.
Mm-hmm.
Don't think you should be doing things like that.
Right.
That's not... And don't get too smart for yourself and think this body is superfluous or unnecessary to the spiritual process. Right? It's not, in fact. God gave it to you, so it's your job to take care of it. So it doesn't mean you need to, you know, go to the spa every day and have massages and be completely physical either. But don't ignore it. You're not allowed to do that. What were you going to ask?
I was just curious that I've often wondered this, where like the women of the Orthodox community can go. Did they have like a workout facility or something like that? Or
And there's Curves, which is a female-only place.
Okay, all right.
So they could do that. It's not open on Sundays, which is a hassle for Orthodox women because
right.
that's a big day.
Mm-hmm.
And then different women do different things. Some women are willing to work out in relatively clothed in the presence of men that they don't know. So they'll just go to a little further away, 24-hour fitness or something like that.
Okay.
And they'll wear exercise pants, maybe a skirt on top, maybe not. They'll keep their hair covered,
okay.
you know, with a scarf or something. And even some might swim in front of men, but they would wear a bathing suit and a t-shirt. Okay, is that how they would walk on the street? Absolutely not.
Mm-hmm.
Are they more modest than the environment? They are. So different women make different compromises in what they and choices of what they want to do.
Mm-hmm.
In Orthodox areas, which is not Denver, Colorado, there are gyms for women.
Okay.
And certainly in Israel, in Lakewood, and places like that, there are all-female places where you can go and Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then they do, and some women get together in each other's houses and have, like, somebody will be a personal trainer and teach 5-6 women, 10 women. They'll have a steps class or whatever, different things.
Yeah, we had a group of women we met in a school on the west side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I mean, depending on the interest. And then there's always walking and that kind of stuff, which they do. Yeah.
Which is the best.
Yeah.
There was Mademoiselle at one time. That was an all-female.
Right, there are some all-female.
Mademoiselle was the...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was a foyer.
I remember that.
Yeah, so there's places like that. People just go to places like that. In some places also where there's more of an Orthodox influence, a JCC will be responsive. So this JCC has occasionally had women's swimming hour once a week for short periods of time, 6 months here, 3 months there.
I think they still do.
You think they do right now?
I know someone who knows.
Oh, they have women swimming now? Oh, okay, so they have women swimming now, 1 hour a week or an hour and a half, something like that. A week is all women. So occasionally there'll be something like that. In a busier area, in Detroit, let's say, they'll probably have 3 or 4 times a week for women. So women only and men only. Mm-hmm. So that there would be those separate hours if people want that.
I've just always been curious about that.
Yeah, that's what there is. Okay, so now let's look at just the first thing here about in this mitzvah about letting the hair grow long. Right, this is the mitzvah which has the philosophy of a nazir in it, but it also has it's the mitzvah of letting a nazir's hair grow long. So, apparently, many Nazirim became a Nazir. They took upon that oath because they felt there was something to correct. They maybe went too far. Let's just say, in today's language, a college kid graduates. And they realize, you know what? College was not that good an experience for me. You know, I learned a lot of stuff. I got my degree, but I also did stuff I should not have been doing, really. I want to now kind of take a, just to create balance, because not a permanent thing, I want to veer into the spiritual and let go of some physical for a while. I'm a nazir for a certain amount of time. So that would be the type of thing. So it would often be to correct, you know, some indiscretion or overindulgence in the physical. But here it talks about, it's interesting, there's a certain Rav Shimon HaTzadik said of himself in the Gemara Tractate Nazir, page 4b. In all my days, I did not eat of the asham, a guilt offering, of the Nazir except once, of a defiled Nazir except once. What does it say? Okay, let's just read this note on 4. If a Nazir becomes ritually unclean, which is one of the things he's not permitted to do, during his period of consecration and abstention, he had to bring a lamb for an asham offering, a sin offering. But in addition, the days that he had spent as a nazir till then become void, and he has to restart the count. Let's see, right. There's all kinds of things here. What might happen? As the Talmud explains, people who took the vow initially to be a nazir generally did so under emotional stress. Fear, rage, remorse over sins, according to the early commentaries. When they became defiled and had to begin the period as a Nazir all over again, there was a good chance that they would regret their original vow, since it had not been purely for the sake of God, right? That it was about really to save themselves rather than to glorify God or to... So this would cast a tinge of doubt over the validity of their original vow. For if a person expresses his regret of a vow to a learned scholar, he can possibly have it annulled, which we talked about, which in turn would cast a tinge of doubt over the validity of the asham, of the sin offering, right? Is it actually a valid asham at that point? Because was it a valid vow in the first place, so was this the correct continuation of it? Hence, Rav Shimon the Tzaddik generally refused to eat the meat of such an offering, although he was a Kohen Gadol, and the meat was supposed to be eaten by Kohanim. Okay, so now this is what he's saying. We understand that background now, that he didn't want to eat a tinged, possibly tinged asham. But there was one asham he did eat, and that's this one. He said, in all my days I did not eat of the asham of a defiled nazir except once. A certain man came before me from the south. I saw that he had beautiful eyes and was good-looking, and his locks of hair were arranged for him in ringlets. So I just imagine, you know, the original Jufro, that's what they call them, right? But a pretty one, like ringlets all around, like, you know, that crazy kind of curly hair, but pretty. He looked pretty in it. Pretty, not handsome. Like, pretty, right? Why did you see fit to destroy this handsome hair of yours? I asked him, why did you see fit? Because you have to shave it all off at the end. He answered me, I was a shepherd for my father in my town. I went to draw water from the wellspring, and I gazed at my reflection in the water. My evil impulse hastened upon me and wished to drive me out of the world. To it, I said, O wicked one, why do you grow proud in a world that is not yours, over one who is destined to become food for maggots and worms? By the temple service, I swear I will shave you for the sake of heaven. So he looked at himself in the water and he thought, you're so good looking. Look at you, right? And he right away recognizes Yetzirah. And he said, how could you be proud of this? This is going to be eaten up in the end. Like, all of us are going to be worm food. Now, how are you proud of what's just, like, not yet fully cooked for the worms? Like, what's up with you? So that's why. So he didn't make it out of rage or fear or anger. He was very clear, I need some balancing here. And so his was a very clear, appropriate commitment to becoming a mamzer, to becoming a nazir. I stood up at once and embraced him. I kissed him on the head and said to him, my son, may there be many like you vowing to be a nazir. About you does scripture state, when a man shall speak clearly to take the vow of a nazir to become consecrated to the Lord. So he did become consecrated through that. It wasn't just a fear move. So that's the idea, is, and he goes on further. So talking about the hair, right? So you have beautiful hair, right? So hair does affect how we feel about ourselves and what we look like. So a male or a female can become a nazir. So I think this sentence, the first part of the sentence only applies to males, that the concept is that overly long hair or shaved hair make one not pretty. Right? So with women, long hair is pretty. But with men, you look unkempt if your hair is too long, right? So for a man, if his hair is too long or too short, it's not, it's two sides of a spectrum, it's too far. It's not the normal, regular, you look okay kind of hair. So that's what part of Nazirut is supposed to do. You first grow your hair very long, and then you shave it all off, including the payas, the whole thing. Everything's gone. So, and there's all kinds of rules about how long you have to shave it. It has to be shaved all the way down so that there, it's not long enough that you could bend the hair over. So that's how close it has to be. So it has to be like a crew cut, at least like a crew cut, if not all the way. Really supposed to be all the way, but it counts if it's at least like a crew cut.
What about unkempt beards? I've seen some beards that are...
Right. Some people trim them, some people don't.
You're not supposed to take a scissors.
You can take a scissors. You can take a scissors. You can't take a razor.
The razor.
Right, you can't take a razor to the skin, but you can definitely take a scissors to the beard.
Does that apply for women, too?
No, women can shave their faces. So if women have little wispies or whatever they get as they, whatever age they are, they can shave that. Yeah, it does not apply to women. No, so there is something sacred about the beard hair. And so some people feel, so shaving is what's forbidden, but some people feel the sacredness of the beard hair. So for that reason, they wouldn't want to trim it either. So some people don't trim it. Some people who don't trim it still want to look nice, so they at least comb it, and they'll like spin the bottom little wispies and kind of tuck it in under, and that gives them the Burl Ives kind of beard look, you know, like mm-hmm. a kind of a nice rounded. Mm-hmm. So you see some men like that, and sometimes you can tell, and sometimes you can't tell. I think it depends on how full their beard is. But the untrimmed beard look is a look too. I see it a lot in Lubavitch. I don't think Lubavitch is, like, that's just a look. You could tell a Lubavitch guy kind of right away by his beard, what he looks like. Mm-hmm. Which doesn't mean it's only Lubavitch, but it does mean it's largely in Lubavitch. But you'll see that, you know, in other yeshivish communities. But the main thing is no razor, so on the skin. I think you are permitted for regular purposes to use a cream. I never can pronounce that name.
Depilatory,
whatever that's called. Can never pronounce it right. But that. So you could use Nair on your face, which wouldn't be smart, but you could. I'm saying according to the Torah, you could. Not for a Nazir. A Nazir can't. But because where it says don't bring a razor, you can't also either bring a cream. But you could for regular purposes.
So how did they eventually, in the days when they went to the Beis Hamikdash, how did they shave off the head?
With a razor.
But it just didn't go. It didn't go actually on the skin. It was.
No, so for a Nazir, you are allowed to use a razor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is with a razor or anything like a razor.
Right, something that cuts it, gets it all the way down to the bottom. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting it says anything like a razor because for shaving faces today, you can't use a razor, but you can use something like a razor, meaning you can use scissors that cut very close. So some electric shavers are scissors that cut very close. So the skin looks naked. It's not quite probably the same as skin that was actually shaved with a straight edge razor at the barber. But you probably can't tell the moment after each shave. You could probably only tell at 5 o'clock, you know, what the shadow looks like at that point. Today, shadows are so in that, you know,
that's true. The guys like can 3-day growth on
right.
the face.
Yeah, that's the look. Mm-hmm. You know, so they just like take off the top of it. They don't go close.
Right.
It's in case anybody has boys my boy's age. It happens to be mustache Movember this month. So Avi shaved. He usually has that 3-day growth. He usually has that GQ look, but he took that off and he just has a mustache and he looks like in 1970s. It's hysterical to see him. It's such a funny mustache, but it's to raise awareness for men's health and whatever. But it's also to have fun to grow a mustache and look like a freak, but it's okay for Mustache Movember. Okay, anyway. So the purpose of letting the hair grow is for the sake of subduing the evil inclination that lies in what the sages of blessed memory said about hair, that the long hair or the short hair makes you, it just takes away your vanity to be not properly kempt, really is the word, right? Not kept, if you're unkempt. So either way. So that's part of it. Part of the whole process is to break that Yetzirah that one has, but certainly the one around their vanity. So hair is something that we really care about and does make a big difference in our presentation. So that's why hair here is used for part of being a Nazir. Now, it's interesting that from how you cut it, just so we'll finish this particular mitzvah, which is a very long, the other ones go pretty fast. If one cuts it to a point shorter than you could still bend over a hair, then you have to start your count again of your, you know, Nazirut, right? So if they take on 30 days and on day 29 they just decide to, on the lark, you know, get that buzz cut, they get a number 2 or a 3 cut, right? You can't bend that hair over. So then their count starts again. And so they have to start the whole 30 days again. Now, so if they do that, and they were warned, because you have to be warned to get the punishments, but if they were warned and if they did it anyway, they get whiplashes. That's the punishment. 39 lashes. Actually, they get it on each hair that they cut if they were warned by hair, because each hair is its own transgression, but you have to have the warning. So you could never think of a situation like this, but just to think of it, right? So if the guy's walking into the barber and says, somebody says, hey, you're a Nazir, don't go get your hair cut. If you do, you'll be transgressing this verse and you'll incur whiplashes. And the guy says, I know. And he goes and gets his hair cut. That's just one set. But if the guy's sitting in the chair, he's waiting his turn to get his hair cut, and the barber picks up one piece of hair, and the guy says, don't cut it! You're a Nazir! And if you do, you'll incur whiplashes. And he cuts that one hair, he gets whiplashes for that one. Picks up another hair, and the guy says, don't cut it! You're a Nazir! And if you do, he gets whiplashes for every single one that's cut. That he was warned for, that he then cut afterwards. So, because each one is its own Avera. For whatever reason.
And it's not, it's the wine and the hair combined, or either one, or...
So to become a Nazir, it's all that, we'll see the rest of the prohibitions. It's all the, it's grape products, it's hair cutting, and it's ritual impurity. Those are the three things, okay? So, and we'll see what the haircut, and then exiting is a different thing, but becoming a Nazir means you take that on. So we're going to look at the grapes in just a minute. But let's just add the end of this. So becoming a Nazir is, so just on page 53, this precept that whoever vows to be a Nazir is duty-bound to let his hair grow is in force everywhere, at every time, for both man and woman. So men and women can become a Nazir. Doesn't matter if you're in the land of Israel, outside the land of Israel, if the temple's standing, if the temple isn't standing. This precept is in place every time, everywhere, for both men and women. So that means all the laws that we're about to learn this week and next week, not next week because there's no class next week, just reminding everybody, no class next week. So early happy Thanksgiving to everybody, and happy Hanukkah, but we will have a class on the Monday of Hanukkah. It has to do with everybody, every time, every place. All that we're going to learn applies to men and women. That's what I was saying.
So, but it can't be a woman that's married?
Yes.
Because how can she grow her hair long?
She can still grow it. She just has to keep it covered.
Oh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to think about that. But yeah, she still grows it.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking about it.
She can have relations with her husband?
Yeah, she can.
She can?
Yeah. There's nothing about not having relations for being a Nazir. Mm-hmm. No, it's just about growing your hair, cutting your hair, wine products, and ritual impurity, which we'll see specifically is specific kinds. She definitely can have relations, yeah. It doesn't stop that. What else was I going to say about the hair? Oh, yeah, so I was just thinking about it. You know, like today you could say, I was just contemplating it on the drive over. Oh, what if I would do that? You know, you could be a Nazir and you cover your hair, you always look good anyway. Look, doesn't matter what you do. It could grow forever. But I personally hate it when my hair gets long. I let it grow long, usually, not always. I let it grow long enough that I could cut off a ponytail for locks of love or something like that. But it gets super annoying as it gets that much long. Like the first 6 inches of ponytail, no problem, that flips up under my shaytail. But as it gets longer, and my hair's not that thick, but the ponytail like starts to pull and it like slides down the side underneath my shaytail and like pulls it over a little bit and it drives me nuts. And like for 6 months, because I wanted to get it long enough, I have to stick my hand over there and switch my ponytail back to the middle or like readjust or something, and it's annoying. So imagine if I had to grow up forever. It would be so annoying to cover that much hair. So, and certainly people who have thick hair, like a hair like yours, if you'd let it grow forever, it would be super annoying to keep under a scarf all that hair, you know, and for sure under a wig, it wouldn't fit. So,
okay, so that's another question I've always wanted to know. So really Orthodox women that wear wigs when they get married, do they shave all their hair off?
No.
They don't?
No.
They
very
cut it
few.
Really close?
No.
No.
Okay. No. Very, very few do that.
So
very
they
few.
Still have hair. They just don't.
Yeah, you can have beautiful hair.
And where did I get the idea that...
Because there is a small group that does.
Okay.
So Satmar women do and some other Hasidim do. Principally those that come from Hungary, apparently. It started with the concept that was present in Hanukkah too, where and I forgot how you say it, but there's a Latin way to say this, but basically it means the governor gets first rights with the bride.
Right. Yeah.
So if you're going to let the poor virgin bride, 17, 18 years old, have to be raped by the governor first before she gets to be with her husband, right? So that happened throughout history in different places. In Hungary, what they did was the girls shaved their heads. So as soon as they got married, so they'd look disgusting. So the governor would say, "Ugh, I don't want you."
Smart.
So it became a thing in that area for girls to shave their heads when they got married and to keep it shaved to protect them from rape. So the other things have been attached to it, but that's my understanding of the genesis of that custom in that community. It is not widespread. Lubavitch, for instance, are not permitted to shave their heads. The Rebbe said, you're not allowed to be ugly for your husbands. You have to have some hair there. Some of the head shavers have wigs that, even if they just wear the tight black scarves all the time, but some of them have wigs at home for in front of their husbands. They should look prettier for them. But no, you can have plenty of hair. So people do cut it just to make it comfortable, depending on what kind of hair they have. Mm-hmm. So I don't have to cut my hair to keep it under. Like I just don't have that kind of hair. You'd probably want to cut your hair a little shorter.
Yeah.
to cover it if you did, but you would don't have to. So for those who wear like the pretty scarves, you can just have a big pile in the back. They make a little bun and they wrap the scarf around it.
Yeah.
That's fine. For those people who don't have so much hair, I had a friend who used to wear snoods a lot. Snoods are the stretchy, like they have a headband in the bag. And she didn't have, she had short hair like you, but she would put socks in the back of it to hold the bag down and make it look like she had something in there.
Amazing.
Socks are great for stuffing all kinds of things. Whatever you need them for. So she put them in the bottom of her snoot. And I knew a girl who had super, like, super uncontrollable, there is like a Jewish look, right, of that super curly, like, you can't do anything with it hair, that when you're single, you work on it, and you put product on it, and you make it look all the, but still kind of out of control. What do you do with that when you have to cover it? So I knew a girl who, I did find out what she did. So she did, she took a half pony, and she shaved underneath. So that her hair still looked pretty down around her shoulders for her husband, but she didn't have so much hair to deal with underneath what she was wearing because it's just too much and too, you know, out of control. So anybody who's listening to this who has hair like that, I did hear that mixed chicks products are the best for controlling that kind of hair. So I heard from a Yemenite girl, mixed chicks. It's the best kind of super curly Jewish hair product.
Yeah. I think my daughter's best memory of her bat mitzvah class was the girls were all around, they were doing a Shabbaton, and they asked their mora, would you take off your wig? And she did.
Oh, she did? Wow.
Yes, and to this day, my daughter still remembers that and talks about, she was so cute, Mom. She was like really cute, short curly hair. It changed her whole look. I had no idea.
Right.
<you know? laughs>
Yeah, it is different. I've mikvah-lated before sometimes when I didn't recognize the person, and I feel like, I know who you are because you're in our community, but I'm not saying anything. Just like, hey, how are you? And I wait till they write the check. I'm like, oh, that was Mrs. So-and-so. Because it really does change the look.
Yeah.
Especially when they're all drippy wet, you know? I'm like, don't recognize you. Yeah. So, okay, so now that we looked at the hair one, let's go back and start at 368, I think it is. Was it? Yeah, 368. Okay, so now I got kind of a basic idea of what Nazir is about, which we'll flesh out further as we go through these. So 368, that a Nazir is forbidden to drink wine or any strong wine drink. So a Nazir is not permitted to have any wine or liqueur whose main ingredient is wine. So they are allowed to have scotch, bourbon, they're allowed to have those kinds of things, but they're not allowed to have anything that has any wine or grape derivative in it. So they might not even be able to have a kosher sherry or something. I'm not sure. Not sherry. Whatever the hard liquors are that are aged in sherry casks.
Oh, that's like scotch.
Yeah, scotch aged in sherry casks.
Right.
Because the sherry is grape, and it adds a flavor to the... Yeah.
Just as an aside, I'm sorry on the tape, but bear with us. last year I had that wine and cheese and scotch thing for Aish at my house, and it was during kosher month, and they were showing like a whole array of kosher beers and scotches and cheeses and everything, so it was really nice. But I could only buy the scotches that were not aged in the sherry cask, and I did not know why. So this is in protection of a Nazir?
That's, no. Kashrut.
Oh, kashrut. So what does that have to do?
So we can't, we Jews are forbidden from drinking wine, grape juice and wine that that a non-Jew touches.
Hmm.
So let's just go into that a little bit more. So grape juice and wine, particularly wine that's not cooked, and that's why most of our wine is cooked today. It's called Yayin Mevushal, cooked wine.
Mevushal.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
But grape juice and wine that it has not been cooked is what we Jews would use to offer a wine libation on the altar. It had to be not cooked. That standard was adopted by non-Jews for their wine libations to their foreign services, right? Whatever it was. So they adopted that standard. So we, being stringent about Avodah Zarah, about strange worship that's not our own worship, took upon ourselves, the sages took upon us, to not drink any wine or grape juice that was touched, produced, even touched, even moved, by a non-Jew that was not cooked because it might have been used for a libation. Particularly in the olden days when people were very superstitious and very into their avodah zarahs, and they would pour off even like the top of the bottle. They just open a bottle of wine, pour off a little bit to the gods, and then serve it. That makes the whole bottle of wine avodah zarah wine, which is we're not even allowed to get any benefit from it at all whatsoever. You can't drink it, you can't smell it, you can't sell it, you can't wash your hands in it, you can't water your plants with it. You know, benefit from it at all if it's wine, if it's something that was used in an avodah zarah service, right? So just pouring off a drop to the gods at the top of the bottle makes it that. So it was common practice apparently at some point for the big wineries to dedicate some wine to whatever gods oversaw the wine, or even in Christian times it switched over into the monks and the nuns that produced wine giving libations, or using some for libation, which makes all the wine of the winery not kosher. Okay, now you have a sherry cask from Monk's Winery.
Right, the Benedictine monks in
that's
the basement.
Right, right. Yeah. Right. You take their leftover cask, mm-hmm. which they sell to the Scotch Company, and you fill it up with scotch to age in that cask. But the Scotch Company bought that cask on purpose because they wanted the flavor
right.
of that sherry in their scotch.
Right.
Which makes that scotch, according to many, not kosher. Even though it's less than 1/60th, which is our standard of measurement mm-hmm. for what makes something kosher or not kosher when you have a non-kosher ingredient. However, if it gives a positive flavor, there is no minimum standard. So if you're adding in a drop of bacon extract into your omelet, right, it's one drop compared to your entire two eggs. Right? But it adds a bacon flavor and it's actual bacon extract or whatever it is, mm-hmm. that's treif. You can't have it because the flavor is what you're seeking. So that tiny amount, even though it would be regularly be nullified, if it would be a drop of beef juice, let's say, by mistake or that you put in there, you can't really taste that in your omelet. It does not make it treif. Right? Omelet, I'm assuming you're using butter to fry it in, right? Because eggs are powerful. But let's just say it's in a milchik pan, frying it in butter, and a drop of beef juice passes over it. You're doing the dishes and whatever, it's splashed. It's kosher because it's less than 1/60th, no problem. But you put an eyedropper full of bacon extract in your egg to make it taste bacony, mm-hmm. treif.
Well, it wouldn't be a kosher bacon extract.
No, it wouldn't be. I'm saying you get treif, non-kosher bacon extract, and you put in a drop on purpose into your omelet, and it's less than 1/60th, it makes the whole thing treif because you put it in, A, on purpose, but B, to make it taste like that. The taste is what you're seeking. So that's why. So that being said, however, you should just know that while our VOD is stringent on that with the sherry casks, some other kosher certifying agencies are not in that particular case.
Right.
So it doesn't mean that if you go to somebody else's house and they serve that you can't drink that. Mm-hmm. But it does probably mean that in this city, you probably shouldn't buy that to serve in your house. So it's not kosher, according to many.
Mm-hmm.
Our VOD is stringent and doesn't permit it.
Okay, thanks for explaining
So it's mm-hmm. it's important to understand this.
It is, totally.
It is. Now, because all this is important, and this does have to do with this, so we can go a little further. So with many of our wines today, our Kedem grape juice and many of our kosher wines are cooked. Now, cooking does reduce the flavor profile. So the way that, but the non-cooked wines are the snob wines. They're the ones that, you know, people who care from wines, they want those, right? Nevertheless, and now we have, I think because of this whole Baal Tshuva movement and mixing in of many previously secular Jews who know from real wine, right, it has completely changed our Jewish wine landscape in the last 30 years, right? 30 years ago, you could get what? Only.
Manischewitz.
Mug and Dubbin. That was it, right?
Yeah.
That was it. Today you can get fabulous wines.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when my niece Ricky was born, she's 29, right? She was the first granddaughter. So we went to a kosher wine store. We went to a wine store in Manhattan to buy champagne to celebrate her birth. So we walked in, my husband and I walked in, we said we want a bottle of good kosher champagne. And he looked at us and he said, do you want good or do you want kosher? That's what he had to ask.
Oh, gosh.
But today you can get good.
Yeah.
But at that time, I just remember it so clearly, he just looked at us. He was like, do you want good or do you want kosher? Meanwhile, we did buy whatever. And we went over to our cousin's house to celebrate. Israeli cousins, not observant. So bring our bottle, and then they served whatever they served. So they hand me a glass of champagne, which I take a sip of, and it was delicious. And I look across the room to my husband, who's saying to me, and I said, this is so good. And he says, I'm like, it's so good. Isn't this great? It's like, I was telling you, if it's not kosher, stop drinking that. I was like, this is great, isn't it? It was so good. That was my only experience with non-kosher champagne. It was delicious. But today there's very good kosher champagne. Anyway, so what they do today is they take the minimum cooking required by halachic standards, which is today, the ruling is pasteurization. It's barely cooked. Some people don't hold by this ruling, but today when wine says cooked, that's basically how cooked it is barely cooked, just hitting the temperature to pasteurize. And they do that, I learned from a Jewish experience, wine and cheese tasting thing, where the Kedem guy came in and explained this. And he said they do that by not pasteurizing the wine, but by pasteurizing the, I think it's called must, pretty sure that's the name, for the juice skin mash of stuff, the before it's been spun and strained and all that stuff, whatever they do to it, to make before they start the winemaking process. It's not clear juice. They wouldn't sell it, you know, for grape juice either. It's the mushed up stuff.
Grape peels?
It's got the peels in it. It's got everything in it. That's what they, when after the machine mushes it up and makes it into juice slush, pulp, right? I think that's called must in the winemaking process. That stuff is called that. That's when they pasteurize it. And then they add in whatever. Then they do the mixing and they add in the whatever they do, inoculating, they add in the yeasts and the things that make it go into the wines. So they do it early in the process, so it doesn't affect it that much, the flavor that much. Because of that, there are those who are stringent and do not hold that way. We as a community, we Orthodox Jews in this, on this continent, basically as a community, do hold that way. However, for those who are stringent, they feel that the temperature that it has to get to is it has to get to a boil and boil long enough that the quantity is reduced in the pot. However long that is, a couple of minutes, but it's boiling until it's reduced. Now, that's real cooking, and that's what ruins good wine, right? But there are those who are stringent and would not hold that that's yayin mevushal unless that happened to it. So, but basically, we hold by the pasteurization technique, and if it says it's cooked on the bottle, it's cooked. Now, how does that work in our lives? So we are just careful. So it turns out it's for non-Jews and non-Shomer Shabbos Jews in public. So if a Jew doesn't keep Shabbos, but lightly doesn't, like let's say they're just not careful. They don't drive on Shabbos. They basically do keep Shabbos, but you just don't know, like, did they unscrew the light bulb in their fridge or not? You know, or are they careful with, you know, not separating out their silverware when they put it, you know, away or not? Like, there are things that they do, and they don't care. Like, it's not like they say, I wonder how you're careful with this law on this. Like, they do break Shabbos, but not in public, right? They're so that kind you can still, that's a different, I'll explain a minute, that's a different line than somebody who in public breaks Shabbos. The one who drives to shul and gets out, or drives to your house and gets out, that's the non-Shomer Shabbos Jew that has the same halachic problem as a non-Jew at your table when you serve wine that's not mevushal. So if you want to serve a fancy wine, the smart thing to do is to serve only mevushal wines if you have somebody like that, or even a housekeeper if you're not serving the whole thing and the housekeeper might touch your wine. So if you're going to open non-mevushal wine, you want to make sure that you either finish the whole bottle among you Shomer Shabbos people, or you pour into each glass yourself and then hand the glass to the person. You cannot put the glass in the hand of the person and then pour into it, because then they're touching what's in their glass, which is touching the stream that goes into the bottle, and the whole bottle becomes not kosher.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and if they want a second glass, don't pour into that little puddle that's left in their glass either. Give them a fresh glass. So if you're super aware, you can do that with a non-Jew or a non-Shomer Shabbos Jew at your table. But in general, we're pretty careful because it's tricky. Like, all they have to do is say, oh, can I see the vintage on that? And the whole thing is garbage now. That's it. So once it's been opened, if it's sealed, it's not. But once you open it, if they, and you're letting it breathe or something, and somebody does that, or if you have help in the house or whatever, and they just move it so they can set the table, done. Mm-hmm. So
you hold that way?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, so I'm careful not to open any non-Mavushal wines in the house unless it's only Shomer Shabbos Jews in the house. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, because it's a whole
thing. I think
thing.
Most wines today are Mavushal.
Most are, but
there are a few.
The more we become aware of fancy wines and the more that we have now entered, I'm claiming ownership over my brethren, the Orthodox winemakers. But as we Orthodox Jews have changed the market, and as winemakers are responding to what we want, and is, as Israel becomes a winemaking force and is winning awards internationally for good wines, the better wines are not Mavushal. So more kosher wines are being produced that are not Mavushal. The grapes have to be harvested by Shomer Shabbos Jews. So from the harvest until the bottling for non-Mavushal wines, it all has to be handled by Shomer Shabbos Jews.
It's like the special matzah.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. So it's a tricky thing, right? The whole, yeah. So, yeah, so it's a lot that has to do. So anyway, all of that, is there anything more about non-Mavushal wines that we should talk about here? Anyway, there's a whole, winemaking is a whole special thing. I'll just say one more thing, because and then we'll do the rest of the mitzvahs next time. But one of the reasons for not having that wine, so that one prohibition is to not have avodah zarah wines. But another prohibition is drinking wine or strong drink with non-Jews. There is a gezeirah against that. It's not that it's not kosher, but even if you have mavushal wine, some people would not open any wine with non-Jews at their table. We do for, I mean, we asked Ashayla, we personally, and some others also do. If it's like a Shabbos meal and you would regularly serve wine at that meal, and they, the non-Jew, is like learning about Shabbat, or they're respectfully sitting at your Jewish table, then you are permitted to serve wine there. But you're not supposed to, like, let's say you go out for a business lunch. Let's say you go to the deli for lunch. It's a kosher place, but you're with your non-Jewish partner. You're not supposed to be drinking at that meal. Drinking alcohol at that meal.
So the,
we have a gezeirah not to drink.
The bottom line.
The bottom line is no intermarriage. It's mixing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Just having a drink, what could lead to lethal?
Well, having a drink lets your guard down. Lets you be familiar with, and I think it's the whole familiarity all together. It's not just that drink that could lead to whatever.
Right.
It's that level of mixing. I'm comfortable with you enough that I'm willing to drink with you, that I'm willing to let my guard down a little bit, that I'm willing to create a relationship that includes that level of unguardedness with you, and that just breeds stronger relationships with Gentiles, which might lead to inviting a whole family over for a meal, which might lead to the kids meeting each other, which might, you know, that.
Got it.
Yeah, so we are careful about that, to not share drinks with non-Jews because of intermarriage. We want to just be careful of keeping a separation and keeping our wits about us whenever we are interacting with non-Jews. Just to, and we should always be, you know, respectful, but we do want to keep a boundary and keep that separation. So that brings us to 10 o'clock.
Thank you.
And we will continue with the laws of Nazirut next time. That's Rosh Hashanah.